This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 14th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to this Wednesday edition of Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up, we chew the fat over the latest Michelin European City Food Guide, and we'll be finding out why the Danes aren't happy. And we look at Google's growing influence on international relations after its map service crossed the line, quite literally, in Central America. We'll also hear how a new sauna could reinvigorate a waterside corner of Helsinki. There'll be plenty of music as well, and a review of the front page. All that in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. But before all that, let's get the news from around the world with Georgina Godwin.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Georgina Godwin. A bus carrying Belgian children home from a school skiing trip has crashed into the wall of a tunnel in the Valais region of Switzerland, killing 28 people, 22 of them children around 12 years old. The Belgian Prime Minister said he was horrified by the news and would travel to Switzerland today. He added that given the magnitude and the exceptional character of this drama and the emotions that it triggers, the government has decided to organise a national day of mourning. 24 more children aboard the bus were injured, some seriously, and are being treated in hospital. The mayor of Lommel, one of the towns where the children are from, spoke earlier.
We have 22 children from this school, children of 11, 12 years that were on the bus, as well as two adults, one teacher and one person who is also working in the school. But we cannot say at this moment who is a victim and who is not. We don't have that names already.
UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan has received a response from Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to his proposals for ending the country's violence, but he's still seeking answers to outstanding questions. The former United Nations Secretary General outlined steps that needed to be taken, including a halt to fighting, humanitarian access, and starting a political dialogue. A spokesman for the Syrian Foreign Ministry said Syria had given a positive response to Annan's proposals. The anniversary of the Syrian revolt falls tomorrow, and the army appears to have multiplied its attacks on opposition strongholds this week, sweeping rebels from the northwestern city of Idlib and sending up to 130 tanks and armoured vehicles to the southern city of Deraa. The United Nations estimates some 8,000 people, many of them civilians, have died in the last 12 months. Today, French President Nicolas Sarkozy denounced Assad as a murderer, but ruled out any prospect of France intervening militarily as it did in Libya last year. The Chinese premier announced earlier that Beijing was taking no sides in the crisis and that he was deeply pained by the suffering of the Syrian people. Amnesty International issued a report today saying Syria should be referred to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. However, only the UN Security Council can do that, and it remains divided. Speaking at a joint press conference with US President Obama, Britain's prime minister has warned Assad that international law has a long reach and a long memory on human rights violations. The International Criminal Court at The Hague has found Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga guilty in its first ruling since it was set up 10 years ago. Lubanga was convicted of recruiting and deploying child soldiers during a five-year conflict which ended in 2003. An estimated 60,000 people were killed in the period. He was detained 6 years ago and faced three counts of war crimes. He could be imprisoned for life, although a sentence will not be passed immediately. An appeal may be filed within 30 days. Geraldine Mattioli-Zeltner from Human Rights Watch welcomed the verdict.
I think it's definitely a success for the ICC. I think it's more than that. It's really a victory for the victims of Lubanga's horrible crimes, of the thousands of child soldiers who were recruited in his group.
U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta told troops in Afghanistan today that the massacre of 16 Afghan civilians by an American soldier should not deter them from their mission to secure the country ahead of a 2014 NATO withdrawal deadline. Panetta arrived in Afghanistan amid heightened tensions over the killings, underscored by a motorcycle bomb blast in Kandahar City that killed an Afghan intelligence soldier and wounded two others, as well as a civilian. Meanwhile, an Afghan stole a vehicle and drove it onto the runway ramp around the time Panetta arrived on his unannounced visit. The driver of the vehicle at Campastian Air Base caught fire, but it was unclear how, and a spokesman denied reports in Afghan media that the vehicle itself had caught on fire or exploded. The secretary, we believe, was never in danger, said the spokesman. And US President Barack Obama said today that the window for a diplomatic solution with Iran over its nuclear program was shrinking, and he encouraged Tehran to seize the opportunity of talks with world leaders to avert even worse consequences. Obama said Iran's tendency had been to stall and delay in talks with world powers. Iran said its nuclear program is peaceful. The United States and its allies are concerned Tehran wants to build a nuclear weapon. And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Georgina. Just a quick look at the front pages of the Australian and New Zealand press this morning. And the tax reforms for businesses in Australia making the front pages of most of the papers. Start with the Australian. Tax cut, not reform, says business. And businesses calling for a greater cut to the 30% company tax rate. It's gone down just by 1%. Labour were trying to slash it to 25%, blaming problems within the coalition for the hold-up on such a move. And it's also covered by the Sydney Morning Herald as well, with a quote from Julia Gillard saying, "I never thought I would see the day that the Liberal Party would join with the Greens to vote against a tax cut for business." That's straight from Prime Minister Gillard. And also on the Sydney Morning Herald, lost for 11,500 years, another part of the family. This is the Red Deer Cave people, discovered in a part of southwest China, believed to have lived 11,500 years ago. But they look very different to those in Africa 150,000 years ago and modern man. There's an artist's reconstruction on the front of the Herald of what these people look like. And there's also the skull that was recovered. And looking at the New Zealand Herald, breast cancer results delay an urgent inquiry with claims that delays in diagnosis of cancer in women has put many at risk, at least eight linked to specific failings in hospitals. And on the New Zealand Press, there's a picture of the Wizard of New Zealand calling for mobs in the street to sign petitions to save the Christchurch Cathedral, which could be demolished after suffering extensive damage from the earthquake. That's all from the front pages. It's time to look at the weather now with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And it's quiet on the weather front across most of Europe. The best weather conditions are across Iberia, France, the Alps and Italy. It's sunny here. Across the UK, the sunshine will come and go rest of the week. And if you're in London over the coming days, I think tomorrow, Thursday, looks best. End of the week in Central Europe, warming up to 17 degrees. It's Thursday's City Outlook. In London, 16 degrees, partly cloudy. Frankfurt, also 16 with some clouds. In Milan, it's a sunny 17. And in Helsinki, 0 degrees, so cold and also overcast. North America now, and Mother Nature in the United States has got her months mixed up. It feels more like mid-May across the eastern half of the country, especially the Midwest and the Mississippi, with highs reaching 26 degrees in Chicago, for example. California, on the other hand, is looking awful. Cool, rainy, even stormy. So if you're off to San Francisco, well, LA might be a better bet further south. It's Thursday's City Outlook. In New York City, 16 degrees, partly cloudy. Washington, D.C., 22 here, mostly sunny. Chicago, as warm as 23, sun and a chance of some thundershowers. But in San Francisco, 14 degrees and rain. How about around the globe? Japan looking fine next couple of days. That is Tokyo. Some sunshine, around 10 degrees. The weekend is wet, though. Somewhere tropical, Bangkok, highs here reaching 36 degrees, it's very humid. In Kuala Lumpur, around 31, but in Sydney, the sun's shining, it's fairly sunny and 27. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomash. It's 18:09 here in London, 9 minutes past five if you're waking up in Melbourne. We'll be back with Midori House in just a moment.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ja, joo, kasa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. Welcome back. Now, few can argue with the clout the Michelin Guide carries amongst gastronomers. Chefs practically salivate over the prospect of a 3-star rating from the illustrious foodie guide, but Michelin's latest European cities edition has left Danes furious and food critics puzzled as to why Copenhagen's much-lauded Nummer failed to gain a 3rd star. 3-star ratings were handed to 2 eateries in the UK, 2 in Italy and 8 in France, but Denmark has still yet to have any 3-star restaurants. Well, joining me on the line to discuss this year's list is our correspondent in Copenhagen, food journalist Michael Booth. Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thanks.
There's been a lot of discussion about whether Nummer should have got this 3rd star. Is it deserved criticism of Michelin not to give this star, or what's your view of Nummer, and is this a lot of PR coming from Nummer itself?
Oh no, it's not PR on behalf of Nummer in that sense. It's more on the behalf of Michelin. This is an annual story, right? Every year, it's will Nummer get its 3rd star? And no, it never does. And that's good for Michelin because it stirs up conversations like the ones you and I are having now. But I guess ultimately it's good PR for Nummer as well. But I think the problem is Nummer has for the last 2 years has come top of this 50 best restaurants in the world list. And the rumor is that Michelin doesn't like it for that reason and isn't giving it that 3rd star. That's one of the mooted reasons, is that it's a bit jealous or a bit annoyed that another rival restaurant kind of guide or rating list has so supported Nummer in the last couple of years. So
it's more about snubbing the rival critics, yeah, then, rather than the restaurant itself.
That's one argument. The other is, you know, when I've spoken to René Redzepi, the head chef at Nummer, about this in the past, he's very clear. He would love to get a 3rd star. He's very upfront about that. But he hasn't been prepared to change what he does in the restaurant in order to get it. Like many other restaurants know what to do, and they go after it, and they buy expensive linens and expensive cutlery and this kind of stuff. But still, René doesn't have all those kind of fripperies. And he serves courses like live shrimp on a bed of ice. And, you know, Michelin is never going to understand that. I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think Michelin is too focused on formal settings? Certainly in the past it's been criticised for worrying too much about the ambiance of a restaurant rather than the food itself.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to the prize 3-star rating, it's very classic. And that's why I think 11 out of the 15 3-star restaurants in Europe are in France, most of them in Paris.
Yeah, it's very French-leaning, isn't it? It's almost, some have suggested there's a French bias towards the cuisine and also the style of presentation.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, it's a French guide. And what's the French for chauvinism again?
Do you think it's got as much value and clout as it once did, Michelin? With the advent of all of these rival guides, is Michelin as important as it once was?
Well, you know, we're talking about it. If you look on Twitter, that everyone's talking about it, and who's interested in food, it does stir things up. Let's put this into perspective. It's not the Arab Spring or Fukushima or Syria, but if you're into food and into restaurants, then this release of this European Cities Guide is an important thing. And if you talk to chefs, there are some like Christian Pugliese of Relais in Copenhagen, who has just won a star, who are not that interested in winning them. They almost go in the opposite direction. And there are others like the guys at Franzen Lindberg in Stockholm, who have 2 stars, and they're very clear. They're absolutely desperate to get that 3rd star, to be the first restaurant in the Nordic region to get 3 stars. And they're throwing loads of money at it, and they still haven't quite got it. The restaurant I'm most excited about, if I can just continue for two seconds, is straight in with 2 stars, which is almost unprecedented, is Maemmo in Oslo, which coincidentally I visited a couple of weeks ago and did a piece for Monocle 24's The Menu. So I'm very proud to have been there before Michelin.
Absolutely. These stars are few and far between in the Nordic region, and it's astounding this restaurant has catapulted straight into 2-star status. Is that almost salt in the wound for the likes of Nummer and other restaurants that have so far not managed to get even 1 star, or in Nummer's case, 3?
Well, it really does point up the, if we're being polite, the idiosyncrasies in Michelin's methodology. And those are thrown into even starker relief if you go to Japan and see the kind of restaurants that Michelin just showers with stars in Japan, which are in underground car parks and only serve beer and have six people sitting there, that kind of stuff, which if it was in Europe wouldn't get a look in. So there's a very, very weird system, if there is any system going on there. And then, you know, Miamo deserves to get its two stars, but does it deserve to get them so quickly? That's quite a shock. Does Noma deserve to have three stars? Personally, I think it does. One of the greatest meals I've ever had was in Noma. Yes, it doesn't have linen tablecloths, and yes, the chefs come out and serve you the food, but that's part of what's great about that. And I think there is a feeling generally that Michelin should lighten up about some things.
Essentially, Michael, what is the difference between the ratings given in, say, Japan, which you just mentioned, to those in Europe? Is it the panel of judges is a separate set, or is it the competitive environment here in Europe?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, Michelin are very cagey about who their inspectors are. I know that some will go from head office to Japan to check out restaurants, but they will have their in-country inspectors as well. So I suspect that's a commercial decision. They launched in Japan a few years ago, wanted to launch with a bang, wanted to do really well, and what they did was they just threw stars at Japan. So I believe it has more Michelin stars than any other country on the planet. Whereas it's been in France, of course, in Europe for many, many decades. So I guess they become more entrenched in their ways in Europe. Japan was a chance for a fresh start. So there does not seem to be any rationale about it. A restaurant, genuinely, a restaurant in a rubbish little hole in a car park that only sells one type of beer can get a star in Japan. It wouldn't get a star in France.
I might go and set up myself over there. Any other surprises from this year's list, Michael?
Well, Tom Akins in London has lost a star. He's quite a big name in London. Les Ambassadeurs at the Crillon Hotel in Paris has lost a star. Pierre de Terre in London has lost one. I think personally I'm most astonished that Gordon Ramsay still has three stars for his eponymous restaurant, flagship restaurant in London. That's a bit weird. Heston Blumenthal's got one for Dinner, which is totally deserved. Jason Atherton's got one for Pollen Street Social, which has been a massive, exciting new restaurant opening in recent times in London. Rising stars to Polpo and Barrafina. I think a lot of people will be happy to see that.
And lastly, what was this dish that you had in Noma that you lauded as one of the best you've ever had?
Oh, well, there were many, really. The whole meal was just the greatest meal I think I've ever had, one of the greatest meals I've ever had. But there are many, many radical and bizarre dishes you get at Noma. For example, the first thing you get is a bulrush, the root of a bulrush, which is about half a metre long, and you have to dip it in a little dip of yogurt. So it's just a very weird thing to have. And then you get a little kiln jar filled with shaved ice and two little live shrimp dancing about on the ice, which you have to eat alive. It can be quite challenging.
Yeah, it sounds it. I'd like to say I'm feeling hungry after this chat, but I'm not so sure. Michael, thank you so much for that. Food journalist and Monocle contributor in Copenhagen, Michael Booth. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The April issue of Monocle is something of a vote winner, as we look at the power of parliaments from Europe's high north Sami HQ to Addis Ababa's new gathering place for the African Union. We also limber up for our Olympic series as we head out on the Tigris with Iraq's rowing team. Then there's a look at doing business in Wellington and a frothy soap story from Portugal. And our editors have lots more to offer too. In the business section this month, we'll head down under to New Zealand's small but perfectly formed capital, Wellington. With a comparatively tiny domestic market, this Antipodean David is taking on the Goliath task of creating knowledge-enriched services and products that compete on a global level. We also head to Kentucky to review the Farm Machinery Show with Plough Factor and look at the Canadian food retailer who has converted a landmark ice hockey stadium into a flagship store that reconnects with quality retail. There are also recipes for a cosy dinner and recipes for business success courtesy of a Paris meets New York publisher. The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand. Some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now we head to Helsinki, where an ambitious new building project is hotting up. The Kulturasauna, or Culture Sauna, promises to bring about something of a rejuvenation to a run-down waterfront site in Marihaka. The architect, Thomas Tuovneven, it says he's hoping to take the Finnish tradition of saunas back to the 1930s, when the country boasted more than 300 bathhouses. Tuomas joins me on the line now. Tuomas, how are you?
I'm good. Greetings from Helsinki.
And now how is it there at the moment? Is it chilly? Are you in need of a sauna to warm up?
Well, actually, in my apartment building, we have a shared sauna in the building, and my sauna shift starts in 40 minutes, so I'm waiting.
Your sauna shift, you have to share it in a shift system.
I have a weekly turn at the sauna. It's Wednesday nights. So I think one of my neighbors from the fifth floor is now occupying the department until 9 o'clock, and then it's ours to use.
Oh well,
This is a kind of typical. It's a very typical institution to have a sauna in an apartment building like this. But also we have a tradition of public saunas.
Yes. Well, I won't encroach on your time allotted time slot in your sauna, but I was going to ask you, Tuomas, if people have them in their flats now, in their apartment blocks, is there such a need now for these public spaces and these public saunas, one of which you're designing?
Yes. Of course, nowadays in larger apartments, in new apartments, people do build saunas, but the sauna that you can build into a small apartment, it's a bit like a wooden closet with a hairdryer. It's a very different instrument than to have a large sauna with almost 2 tons of stones that are heated to 600 degrees, glowing kind of red hot. And when you throw the water on those stones, the kind of löyly, the steam that kind of kiwa stove gives you is a completely different animal than an electric heater attached to a closet in the bathroom, and somehow people really go to the public saunas, to the old saunas, in search of that authentic, the real experience. It is something much more than just the temperature. It's the whole experience.
What will make it, as you call it, a cultural sauna? What sort of culture will you find in there?
Well, the name has a kind of a double story. First of all, I think the building will run as a kind of platform for a lot of things that we, its designers and operators will kind of bring there, cultural events, music, especially publishing. Discussions, roundtables, seminars, and we have a small cafe, so to kind of connect that together with the kiosk, maybe it's a nice place to spend time. We also have a small courtyard with a birch tree. In summertime, it's perfect for all kinds of events. The other angle is that also our architecture office, our design office is moving under the same roof. So during the daytime, it takes quite a long time to heat the sauna. We need to be in the building, and so we're going to be working in the building at the same time. And for example, next spring, we're doing a collaboration with an architecture school, and we're having a kind of in-house academy. And actually, the building will double as an architecture school for during a 12-week period. And then the name Kulttuurisauna is actually a reference to a text written in the 1920s, 1926, by a young Alvar Aalto, the kind of national architect of Finland, who was he was 25 years old, and he hadn't built much, but he proposed in his hometown in Jyväskylä to build a new kind of building, a public sauna, but a kind of temple.
A national monument or some sort.
A national monument of sorts, yes. A kind of place for more than just, you know, kind of washing oneself, but in a way for the advancement of civilization. And this kind of, the idea of, in a way, the Roman bath or the forum as a kind of, as a small public building that kind of incorporates food, drink, company, and then this kind of bathing, which Finns is a very spiritual affair also. It's a place to be by yourself with other people. It's silent, it's contemplative, and it's somehow a very physical experience, but it also kind of, it's really space to think.
We'll touch on Finland's relationship with saunas in a moment. And as you say, they go back to as far back as the 1920s. And they've been in decline, public saunas, that is, have been in decline since then. But what about the area you've chosen to build this in? It's not the most popular or busy area at the moment, is it, in Helsinki? Why did you decide to go to Merihaka?
Well, Merihaka, just to kind of, for the listeners who are, you know, not from there or who are not so familiar with it, it's a housing area in the very center of Helsinki, just off the left, the east side of the kind of city center, and it's a kind of mega project built in the 70s. It's a sort of kind of like a Barbican of Helsinki in a way, without the museums. And so it's a concrete structure with a kind of raised deck for pedestrians with cars underneath, and people who live there are actually very happy and very proud of their area. It's an area with a really strong identity. Everyone knows it, but somehow their identity is also something that maybe it would be nice to live there, but it's not nice to look at it, you know. But it's a neighborhood that lacks. It doesn't have any destinations in it, so it's mostly housing, and then it used to have the central tax office, which is not a particularly nice attraction in your town. So there's kind of a shadow of it's an unfun gray part of the city, a kind of a small kind of concrete fortress just by the sea. But it's amazingly peaceful. It's super well situated, and it has an amazing waterfront with no cars. And it's one of the places which is kind of free of traffic in a really wonderful way. And our building is at the very extreme kind of southeast corner of this, with open views to the center of the city, to the Orthodox Cathedral, to the outer archipelago, and this kind of artificial peninsula that was built there in the 1970s was kind of forgotten, and there was a master plan to build a cafe on it, and for 30 years no one wanted to build a cafe. And the cafe, I guess, would have been a destination, a reason for people to go there, and we applied to rent this site for our building, and today we just signed the land lease for 30 years.
Tuomas, I must leave it there. I'm so sorry. I could listen to your plans for a lot longer, and I do wish your project all the best. We didn't even have time to talk about your wrapping urban planning tutorials that you offer to students.
We'll get to that next time.
Architect in Helsinki, Tuomas Toivonen, thank you so much for that. We'll go straight to a song now. This is Banner by Lights. That was Lights by Banner. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll hear how Google Maps can cause diplomatic tensions. We'll also be speaking to an American baseball journalist who features on the latest issue of Monocle magazine. Culture editor Robert Bounds in the house as well. But first, let's go to Georgina Godwin with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 news headlines, I'm Georgina Godwin. A bus carrying Belgian children home from a school skiing trip has crashed in Switzerland, killing 28 people, 22 of them around 12 years old. There's heightened violence in Syria ahead of the first year anniversary of the uprising tomorrow. The UN Arab League envoy has received a response from the Syrian president to his proposals for ending the country's violence, but he's still seeking answers to outstanding questions. The International Criminal Court at The Hague has found Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga guilty of 3 counts of war crimes in its first ruling since it was set up 10 years ago. US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta arrived in Afghanistan as the United States tries to contain fallout from a massacre of 16 Afghan civilians by an American soldier. The Pentagon has confirmed that a stolen vehicle crashed on the runway as Panetta arrived, but that the official was never in any danger. And US President Barack Obama said today that the window for a diplomatic solution with Iran over its nuclear program was shrinking, and he encouraged Tehran to seize the opportunity of talks with world leaders to avert even worse consequences. And those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Georgina. It's 31 minutes past it, or 32 minutes past the hour here in London. And joining me in the studio now is our culture editor, Robert Bound. He's here to talk about the new issue of Monocle.
Hi, Christian.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm not bad.
Well, I spotted an error, didn't I, just as we were going to the news.
I was going to sit you down
slap
in Studio Lewis. One and give you a quick lesson in American sports.
Yes, a cardinal sin calling basketball
baseball. Baseball's on the bases, Christian.
No good.
Come on.
Ah, so tell me all about this edition of the magazine. It's looking very nice. We've already commented the other day, I spoke to Sophie about the front page, the front cover of the Sami people. But you...
In the culture section, I've always wanted to do a story on sports writers. It's always a lot of people, no matter what stripe they're whether they went to school or not, whether they went to university or not, always turn to the back page of the newspaper instead of the front page. Whether you're a New York Times reader or whatever newspaper you read, you might be turning to that section to get your football, your cricket,
your basketball,
Christian. Which would you rather?
I'm basketball. I used to play
you're
basketball.
All over it, aren't you?
You know my height. I'm 6 foot five.
You'd be a pretty good. You're pretty good line defense.
But alas, I injured myself. I dislocated a knee playing basketball.
You'll see in the pictures that accompany the story.
Brings back all
now,
the bad memories, actually,
does it?
I must say.
Is that why you wanted to, you shut it out by calling
yes,
it baseball?
Yes, that's why I call it baseball, yeah.
Just imagine what could have happened if you played baseball instead, though. I mean, you could have, you know,
I could have been making a lot of money.
You could have been hitting the nuts.
It's
come
true,
on.
Actually. Like, a ball hurtling towards me like that.
Exactly.
Not keen.
And they're harder. Those ones.
So what was it like? What was it like talking to somebody who's this is their life? This is, I mean, you're all things culture. Were you ever tempted to go all things sport along the way?
I've never been tempted to do it, but I'd love to do it. I think it's always one of those things. You know, sometimes in newspapers when the ballet correspondent has to, go into a football match,
yeah,
and vice versa, and all this kind of thing. I kind of like mixing it up. I'd love to do that. And I think all great, you know, it's not just Norman Mailer and all these kind of people, the people that have sort of made an art of sports writing. There are still people that do it every day in pretty much, well, in the better quality newspapers, but all around the world. We've got someone, the lead guy in this is a guy called Howard Beck, who, as we were talking about, is the basketball correspondent for the New York Times.
And tell me a bit about his career. I mean, how much do we know about, you know, his background? He's 43 now.
I think he's been there for a while, and I think you learn the ropes. You start off as kind of a cub reporter, but a lot of people kind of stay at that level. You probably get you get paid more, you get a little bit of extra seniority, maybe you get a comfier chair.
I'm sure you get treated in the
office, because I don't think these guys are in the office very much. These people are, you know, they're not news editors like some of the people upstairs, like maybe I do for the culture. They're always out. They're on the they're at the training grounds. They're at all the matches. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, good relationships with players, with managers, and I think it's an old school form of journalism. These are people that still write in shorthand, that don't take laptops to press conferences because they can't. And this is the domain of shorthand note taking and dictaphones, Christian. I think it's a really fascinating story. I kind of wish I could have kind of done these all myself.
Oh
actually.
No!
Because we've got a Kenji Hall, a man in Tokyo, went to visit an ice skating, which is an ex ice skater. And now she writes about it for one of the big newspapers in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I think that's obviously a couple of these are snow-based sports. A couple of these are kind of indoor or court-based sports. And the two kind of snowy ones, the two colder ones, are sort of fascinating reading. Ice skating is obviously a massive thing. Like figure skating and ice skating is a massive thing in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got the ski jump correspondent for the Süddeutsche Zeitung.
I love it. Could you get more
specific
niche
is that?
Than that?
Yeah. I love that. Wouldn't you love that? I mean, that's like, I mean, he must be able to go on Mastermind and answer 20 questions perfectly on that.
On that. Yeah,
and
but what about in the
what
summer?
Happens what when the general doing? Knowledge round comes up?
Yeah, exactly. You'd be stuffed. You'd be stuffed. It's a shame. We were going to try and cross to your sports writer, all things basketball, but Howard's unavailable on the line.
Howard's unavailable.
What a shame.
It's okay.
He had to catch the ball.
I can pretend.
We can.
Do you want me to put on an accent?
We were imitating.
We're more professional
before.
Than that.
We are better than
we're
that.
We're going to be okay.
Rob, don't.
So,
else can people find in this month's culture?
So there's that. We also went to El Salvador. David Kaufman wrote a great Working Life piece about El Faro, which is, I guess, means the lighthouse. And it is this sort of beacon of free press, I guess, in mm-hmm. a sort of fairly repressed society in terms of the media and all the rest of it. And this is a good thing. I mean, this is something we've been trying to sort out for a while. And I think he's a bit of a linchpin. He's a bit of a, maybe we can call him a pinch hitter. Should we go back to baseball?
Yeah, go on then. Why not? I wondered what you said then.
You might
carry on.
You might say El Salvador's media scene is pretty niche as well, and indeed it is. But I think this guy kind of flies a standard for sort of the free press and all the rest of it, and all those regimes, Nicaragua and all the places that are around there, have big problems. So he's kind of one of the people shining a light with his lighthouse.
This is it. The Latin American media is something we're discussing more and more now, particularly as Brazil becomes one of the more prominent economic powers in that region, and the media industry in some of the countries in Latin America failing to catch up, really, and keep a tab and hold governments there to account.
Well, exactly. I think some of these newspapers, some of these media organizations, TV channels too, are kind of great for business. Which is a kind of euphemism for, you know, a lot of brown envelope transactions being done. And
Seeing some countries' press delving into the others' affairs.
I think there's some kind of murky soup, you know, not just at the bottom, but very high up in these organisations, in the governments. So it's people like El Faro that hopefully are shedding some light on this stuff. But maybe, you know, well, we know for a fact with Carlos Dada, who's the guy that runs El Faro, not always popularly.
I think we'll leave it there, Rob. Lots in the culture edition this time around. This is the April edition of Monocle, available on all good newsstands. And that was our culture editor, Robert.
I think we have a song.
We do have a song. Go on, you are going to play Jukebox for us now. What is your song?
So this is another thing. This is Seu. This is the Brazilian singer. This is her third album. She's cool. This is kind of like being serenaded by, this is essentially being serenaded by a hot Brazilian chick.
It's
from her new album, which is called Caravana Seria Bloom. And it's kind of like a road trip from her home in São Paulo up to the beach in Recife in the north of Brazil. And this, what's this song called? I can't remember. But here it is nonetheless.
Here it is. We'll have it after this. Enjoy.
What do you want? What do you want? No, I've got it. Yes, yes. I know when I get it. Yes, when I get it.
You Won't Regret It by Seu. Now, stay tuned. We'll be talking all things Google Maps and the problems that arise from it just after this.
The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy, and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's 43 minutes past the hour here in London now. The world's first maintained maps date back to more than 4,000 years. The ancient Greek artifacts are preserved in clay. By the 15th century, methods of printing make cartography much more widely available around the world, and scientific breakthroughs in measurement helped us build the picture of the Earth that we have today. Then the internet arrived. It didn't take long for Google to roll out ambitious plans to record and map every inch of the planet. It's something of an understatement to say that Google's maps have been something of a hit with the world's online population. But in drawing territorial borders, the internet giants inadvertently reopened some diplomatic wounds, nowhere more so than in Central America. A dispute erupted between Costa Rica and Nicaragua over a small piece of land near the San Juan River on the Caribbean coast. Our next guest has written extensively about the dispute and joins me now. It's cartography expert Frank Jacobs. Good evening, Frank. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good. Now, first question would be, how far back does this row and this issue with Costa Rica and Nicaragua go?
Well, the Google bit dates back just a few years. But if you dig deep in history, it goes back till the mid-19th century, obviously before Google.
And there was a time when they were one country, as it were, a province united.
Exactly.
Things changed, they became separate, and ever since the border has drifted and it's gone in Costa Rica's favour, Nicaragua has become smaller and smaller over
exactly.
the years.
That's the underlying tension that informs the border tensions since then, and also the Google Maps incident, which occurred a few years ago.
So Google Maps effectively gave Nicaragua a bit more land back.
Yes, and I don't think they knew what they were getting themselves into.
No, I'm sure not. And how did this all come about in terms of this most recent row? I believe somebody was dredging the river and a Costa Rican official said, you can't be here, this is our land. And Nicaragua said, go on Google Maps, I think you'll find it's ours.
Well, to be fair, the border, the waters are quite muddied, even literally, because the border winds its way to the ocean quite leisurely and it changes its channel quite often. Nicaragua obviously has a more generous interpretation of where it should wind than the Costa Ricans does. So when they tried to match up their wishes with reality, they were trying to dredge a channel which would have given them that extra bit of land. And as justification, they could point to Google Maps, which had actually given them that land beforehand.
Now, there have been several disputed parts of this border. Mm-hmm. The most recent, was it 1858? That was the last time in which this border was finalised and this dispute goes back to. There are parts of the border between the two that are accepted by both sides. It's mm-hmm. just this island area in the middle.
It's exactly near the end of the border when they almost actually had an agreement on the rest. Just that little bit at the end was in dispute. And it took arbitration even by the American president of the time, which I seem to recall was Grover Cleveland, mm-hmm. To actually determine and fix the border by a third outside party. It has been accepted, it had been accepted, I should say, by both parties since then. But if you go on the website of the official Nicaraguan cartography agency, mm-hmm. you'll see that they have reinterpreted the official map and they have actually adapted to the Google map.
So what Google did was it really did reopen this whole thing. It gave Nicaragua hope that they could
exactly.
get this land back. And for a great amount of time, they had troops there occupying this land to just to maintain a presence there.
Well, they might still be there. I'm not quite sure, but they haven't shot anyone recently.
No, it's not erupted, but it's sort of simmering. And Google walked straight into this without even realizing. But when you look at, you know, the borders all around the world, they can't obviously keep track of every single one, and they have to go on the resources that they have. They were obviously working on one map that, you know, was against everything else. Should we put so much influence and power in Google's hands when things like this happen?
Well, the thing is, Google is not an official organization for anything. They're just very popular. Mm. So when they say something and lots of people refer to it, it carries more weight than it should, which I think is also why they must have been quite nervous when South Sudan became independent. Mm. It actually took quite a while before Google Maps drew the border between South Sudan and North Sudan, because obviously they were quite afraid that they would make a mistake.
And there's also a precedent in Europe as well, less bitter than the one we saw in Latin America, but it was involving Holland and Germany.
Yes.
And they literally cut a town in half and gave some of it to
Holland.
Well,
less likely to cause a shooting war, at least one would hope. It wasn't exactly a town, it was like a river estuary in the north where the land border between both countries ends and it kind of peters out into an area called the Dollard. And the border runs the official border actually runs straight through it. But Google Maps had placed a border right on the German shore and even with an indentation into the actual harbor of the German town. So that must have been quite annoying for that town.
When they outline these ambitious plans to cover every part of the world, and now they have these gimmicky parts where they go underwater, don't they, and tourist attractions, they're very keen to be the destination for mapping on the internet. With that comes this grief, you could call it simply.
Well, you could say with great popularity comes great responsibility.
Absolutely. Now, is there anything they can do to make to avoid these sorts of things, or are they just bound to happen?
Well, I'm quite sure that they do take a lot of care and precaution to find the right data. They actually have teams in place that gather data and that study issues in case there's a dispute, and they try to. Their policy is to render the situation as closely as possible to the facts on the ground. Obviously, there's always going to be a difference of opinion about what those facts on the ground actually are. So I think they've been quite lucky so far. So
we could perhaps see more disputes in the future. It sounds like quite a laborious task and a costly one to consult with each country about their official boundaries and then raise the conflict of the conflicts between two countries with a third party.
Absolutely. And as in the case of Nicaragua and Costa Rica, they based their strange and faulty map on data from the U.S. State Department. So instead of going to either of the parties in the dispute, they went to a third neutral party. You could say the successors of Grover Cleveland. But for some reason, they got it wrong. So you have to ask yourself, how did the U.S. make this? Why did the U.S. make this mistake in handing this data over to Google?
Lastly, Frank, is there any one body, I don't know, the UN, somebody that can oversee this and sort out boundary disputes and help Google, who is now the biggest company to create such a tool that the entire world now looks to?
That's a good question. Maybe it's just down to competition. Maybe we should have a look at Bing.
Ah, Frank Jacobs, cartologist expert, thank you ever so much for that. Stay with Midori House, we'll be back in a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24,
this is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Our last stop off in today's Midori House is in Miami, where this year's Cruise Shipping Miami Conference and Exhibition has been running now for 3 days. Understandably, safety has been the main topic this year after the Costa Concordia disaster. On the line, we have Miami Herald business editor Jane Wooldridge. Jane, how are you?
I'm terrific, thanks. How are you today?
Good, good. Lovely day here. And I'm wondering what the weather's like in Miami, actually, firstly.
Perfect, actually.
Really?
Sunny, breezy, and 80 degrees. That would be Fahrenheit.
Oh, beautiful. Am I right in saying safety's been the number one priority at this conference? What have there been any other topics that have come up?
Well, there are always some other topics, but I think safety has been certainly the top of mind subject on many people's minds this year, largely, of course, because of the Concordia tragedy, but some other incidents that have gone on. And the industry is very much concerned with making sure that the things that they do regarding safety are a little bit better recognized and then addressing any issues going forward that they can address to make the industry safer. Obviously, from a financial standpoint, anybody who's in this business needs it to be safe. From a consumer standpoint, we all want to be safe on vacation.
How influential is this conference for the cruise industry and tourism in general?
Well, this in terms of the cruise industry, this is the big cruise industry event every year. It's an annual event. It's been going, 20-odd years. And so you have the president of every major cruise line in the country, and not only in the country, but in the world is here. A lot of the, I would say all of the American, European lines are here. And they're the ones that really own the bulk of the industry. They're not not other players outside of this group.
Am I right in thinking it's a nervous industry at the moment? People must be worried that the tourism numbers for the cruise industry are likely to decline because of what we've seen this year.
Well, I think nervous might be the wrong word, but certainly concerned. And I think the face that people here have tried to put on it, and that's probably accurate, is that safety is very important. They need to make sure that this experience remains safe and so that they can move forward. The beginning of this year was looking very promising for this industry in that the yields, which are actually the margins per passenger, were starting to come up. And they're finally getting a little bit over the economic malaise, and that, of course, when this incident happened, bookings immediately dropped on almost all lines. A lot of people held off from their bookings, and as a result, most of the cruise lines very favorable pricing to get people to rebook. What they are already seeing is that even without much advertising, because most of the lines stopped their advertising for about 30 days, that the bookings are coming back quite strongly. Even on Costa, in fact, bookings certainly are not looking great, but they've even come up there. The result seems to be that the people who have been on cruises before feel very comfortable. They recognize this as a sort of odd anomaly. It's but so much outside the norm of the industry. People who haven't cruised before are not ready to say, maybe this is my year.
Maybe not this year. Looking at the business side of this conference, I'm sure there are many companies lining up to take the cash of cruise operators to allay their fears and to help them reassure passengers. What sort of innovation have we seen at this conference to put aside those fears that we've seen from the Costa Concordia disaster?
Well, there's less of that than one might imagine, and there's a pretty good reason for it, and that's that this is truthfully a very safe industry. There was a statistic the other day that in the past 20 years, something like 29 people have died before the Concordia incident. And last year, a record 16 million passengers worldwide cruised. So the reality is it is very safety-driven. But there have been a lot of seminars on these topics to sort of reinforce the image that there are medical facilities on board, what exactly is available. Again, this is all a business-to-business operation. What will be coming out from the Cruise Industry Association, which is very much involved in this conference, is a statement of policy review of what changes the industry should make. But in terms of hardware, the kinds of things you think maybe one company is going to be selling to the next or a new product, those are actually not so much the kinds of things we're seeing, although there are some new products around telemedicine that are being talked about.
And very quickly, lastly, Jane, if not safety, what do you think the main challenge for that industry is moving forward?
Well, I think once they both assure safety and get that message out to the public, then the real question for cruising is something they've been facing for a long time, which is how do you differentiate products so that you draw more different kinds of travelers to the cruise experience? And in fact, they've been making enormous strides in that. One of the things that always happens at this conference is that a number of lines announce new innovations. So, for instance, this morning, Norwegian Cruise Line announced a new deck configuration on a ship they're building that will have something that might be a surprise to you that there's not more of, but a lot of exterior dining spaces. So that's a kind of innovation. What you really have begun to see is that in the luxury market, travelers are more about experiences and destinations. And so the luxury lines are talking about innovation in those regards. And for perhaps a larger market ship or orientation kind of customer, the what becomes important more is the ship as much as the destination. So the large ship lines are focusing on how do we make our ships more appealing.
Jane, course, thank you very much. We have to leave it there. We've run out of time. Jane Wooldridge, thank you for that from the Miami Herald Business Unit. We're out of time for this episode of Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time to start the day in Asia. Next on Monocle 24 is The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. Stay tuned for that. It's been Midori House. From me, Christian Yeo. Goodbye.